Welcome to UEG Podcast, where we talk about scientific discoveries, educational insights, and professional development within the world of digestive health. Whether you're a clinician, researcher, or just passionate about GI content, this is the podcast for you.
Hello, everyone. My name is Agla, and I'm the host of UEG Talks, educational and hopefully fun dive into GI world and beyond. We're happy to have you with us for another exciting episode. So today we're talking about excellence in functional disorders. For that, we're going to Belgium, and we will be guided by the equilibrist of the gut-brain axis, UEG Rising Star awardee, Tim Van Utsel. Welcome to UEG Talks, Tim.
Hi, Egle. Very nice to see you and happy to be here.
Full disclosure, I'm the happiest because this is a very self-serving episode and I feel like it's a bit of abuse of power. And I have to confess that functional disorders are neither my favorite nor something I excel at. So please do guide me and the whole audience through the functional disorders.
I think you're not alone. It can be quite challenging.
Indeed, indeed. So first of all, I mean, the concept of functional disorders is quite complex. There's a lot of things that we do not know. But in layman terms, how do you define what's a functional disorder to a patient?
Yeah, I think here you really start with the most important point already, and that you need to explain to your patient what is going on. And this is often where we fail. I'm not saying you fail, but we as a medical community, we often fail because what we tend to do is we will run a few tests and tell the patient nothing is wrong and they can go home and relax and live their life. And of course, this is not what we should do because the patient is experiencing real symptoms, which are very bothersome, having a major impact on their quality of life and so on. And so what I always do is I start by repeating their symptoms, restating their symptoms, acknowledging their symptoms so that they realize that I understand that their symptoms are real. And my fellows will confirm this. I always use the phrase, I hear you. And this is really helpful because otherwise patients, they may start repeating their symptoms time and time again as if you weren't listening. So I tell them, I hear you. You mentioned to me that you have really bad pain and it feels like you're going to faint. I hear you. And then I start explaining you that we did a few tests and the test came back normal. But this doesn't mean that the symptoms are not there. It just means that your brain is perceiving so many different input that it can be confusing and can be really painful to them. And what often helps is that you use a kind of analogy which is simple and can be understood by a patient. And I really like the analogy of a filter. So what I mean is, in normal conditions, you would not feel what's going on in your gut, right? Because this can be really bothersome if you would feel what happens in your stomach, in your gut, and so on. And this is because all of these signals are being filtered, as it is, before they reach your brain and before they are perceived consciously. However, in patients with a functional gastrointestinal disorder, there is a problem with this filter. And actually, the brain is continuously bombarded by these signals coming from the gut. And in many patients, this may be perceived as very unpleasant and even painful. And so in this way, patients will understand, well, you did a few tests, they're negative, but still I'm having symptoms. Why? Well, because my filter is not working properly. And then often it depends a bit on the patient, but if you have a patient who can grasp this concept, I will also throw in the term, this is what we call hypersensitivity. And this can be caused by something in your guts, or it can also be caused by something in your brain. And I always like to address this duality between the gut and the brain and the interaction in the first clinic. Because if you do this, your patient will understand why they are having more symptoms when they are a bit more anxious or when they are a bit more stressed, because this is true. All of these patients or a majority of these patients will feel worse when they are working against a deadline, when things are bad at work. And sometimes it makes them think, maybe it's in my head, it's all between my ears. And that's not true. It's just there is an interaction. It can be the gut, the brain, and in most patients, a bit of both. And this really speaks to most of these patients.
Okay, so you're balancing between biology and psychology and drawing that they are neither insane.
I would never use the term insanity.
I think this is a reflection on my practice that if I try to explain this in the simple terms and all the treatment options, and I say that one of the steps might be SSRI, they will say to me, I'm not insane. So that's a failure of my explanation.
I see what you mean. The problem is if a patient comes in and is explaining you, I have terrible pain in my stomach region and I have been to 5 different physicians and it didn't find anything. And the physician's first question is, are you stressed? What will be the message that you're bringing across, right? Then the patient thinks, okay, another one. This is the 6th doctor who is not believing that my symptoms are real and that actually all is in my head. So I'm exaggerating here. I'm sure you don't do it like that. But it's really about balancing. When do you address this psychological component? It's very clear that not addressing it is also being done by many colleagues because they're afraid that the patient will think, well, this physician is not understanding what I'm saying, but not addressing it is not what you should do. You should address it because these patients do feel that this plays a role as well. But you have to find a way that you're comfortable with. And often I will address this after my physical examination. So I will discuss the symptoms and all the tests I've gone through. I will wait, I will examine them. We go back to the desk and then I will address, how do you feel when things are busy at work? Do you feel that your symptoms may get worse? And 99.9% will say, yes, absolutely. And then it's up to you to tell them, this is really normal. And this is what I hear with many of my patients. Because, of course, if you are more stressed and more anxious, it's normal that your brain will suffer more from your symptoms. And this is really what we call this interaction between what happens in your brain and in your gut. And at this moment, we will start using a treatment working on your gut, like spasmolytic, prokinetic, and whatever. But possibly in the future, when these treatments are not very effective, we may want to consider a treatment which can also have an effect on the pain signaling through your brain. And so in this way, you already introduce this concept that maybe in the future, you will use a neuromodulator, you will use psychological therapy. Because if you only mention it at the time when you're ready to prescribe it, that's too late. It's important to address this already as early as possible in your clinical routine. This may help.
I hear you, Tim.
Fantastic.
Okay, so could you explain the balancing act in functional disorders? Because in my mind, the functional disorder is a diagnosis of exclusion. And how do you find the balance between over-investigating and under-investigating? Because the possibilities are actually endless, up to porphyria for stomachache.
Yes, or Takayasu vasculitis, or chronic pancreatitis, or a neuroendocrine tumor, and so on and so forth. So this is really important. That is always what I try to teach the junior doctors, that functional gastrointestinal disorders are not a diagnosis of exclusion. So sorry to correct you here, Egle. But this is really key, because if you are using functional GI disorders as a diagnosis of exclusion, you will run way too many tests. And you are absolutely right. You need to do a few tests to exclude a few very important conditions. For example, bad inflammation, like in the case of IBD, or celiac disease, or in a certain age group, cancer. But you should not do all of these tests, and especially not for the very rare conditions, like the one you mentioned, in all patients. You need to do this in a balanced way. So what I try to do is I listen to my patients, as I mentioned, and I make a positive diagnosis. If there are no red flags, if there are no alarm signs and symptoms, if this is a young patient especially, I will make a positive diagnosis of a functional gastrointestinal disorder like IBS or functional dyspepsia or functional constipation and so on. But I will also explain that we will do a few limited tests to exclude a few other conditions, but I'm very convinced that what you have is irritable bowel syndrome, for example. So make a positive diagnosis. So if I can turn the question around, what message am I giving you if you would come to me with lower abdominal pain and some changes in your stool pattern, and I will keep ordering new and new tests? So you come to me the first time, I do a colonoscopy, a CT scan, and a blood test. You come back, they're normal, and I will do a PET scan, an MRI, a metabolic profile. They come back negative. Next time, I do more tests and more tests and more tests. What message am I giving to you? How does this make you feel, you think?
Not very good. And I also have received patients like this where they are exhausted after years and years and no one either explained to it, no one found anything, and it's still not very nice what they are feeling.
Exactly. It's very confusing to the patient, and it makes them very insecure. Because the message that you're getting across is that you have no idea what you're doing. You're just throwing more and more tests on them and hoping that one of them will be positive. If you as a doctor are in doubt, the patient will be in doubt and the patient will go and find another physician who, in the worst case, may start to repeat all of these tests. So is what we all see in clinical practice, right? So it is important that you limit the number of tests, especially in young people without these red flags. But you have to explain to your patient, why are you doing these tests and which tests are you going to do? If they understand why you are doing them and that you actually know that the diagnosis will most likely be irritable bowel syndrome, usually they will buy this. But you have to explain. You have to explain, always.
Tim, you already touched upon the red flags. The traditional ones are quite clear cut. But the thing is, we have increasing numbers, as well as functional disorders, cancers in young people that are very hard to, you know, to detect early. They are very aggressive. They might have very different presentations. Do you have an algorithm that would sift through those patients? Do you have your own red flags besides the traditional ones that would warrant you to further investigate and maybe do a colonoscopy in a patient, in a young patient, for instance?
It's a great question. And this is why you and many of your colleagues find these disorders of gut-brain interaction, which is a new name for functional GI disorders, so challenging. Because it's very likely that it's irritable bowel syndrome. But you never know. Maybe it is a young onset rectal carcinoma, for example. And this is why we are always doubting, what am I missing? But still, you need to go by the alarm signs and symptoms. If there is no rectal blood loss, the patient is not losing weight, if there is no familial history, if a normal blood test comes back normal, if the fecal calprotectin is normal, then it's fine. You don't need to do additional tests. However, and this is important, I will always tell my patients that we keep our eyes open. This is where we are at this moment, and what you have is irritable bowel syndrome. But if your symptoms do not respond to the first and second line treatment as I would expect to, or if your symptoms are changing or getting worse, or you are developing new symptoms, well, we may need to do additional testing. So it's important that the patient understands that you will stay focused. But it would be wrong to do a colonoscopy in all patients. It's not feasible, not for the healthcare budget, not for you as gastroenterologist. And also, it's not in the benefit of the patient.
And also, it comes with all the risks. I mean, 1 in 1,000 will get a bleeder. 1 in 3,000 will get a perforation.
It's rare, but it's also something to take into account. And let's be honest, most of the patients coming to us as gastroenterologists with bowel syndrome, they have not had just one colonoscopy. They have had 3, 4, 5 colonoscopies. So this is bad practice. This is not what we should do.
Do you think that we can address this? Because I have a sense that there's a part of patients with functional disorders that also this cancer scare and all the media drive them to what at least my colleagues call treating colonoscopy, for instance, where you do the exam not because it's indicated, but because the patient is so anxious of getting cancer that you need reassurance that there's no other way to reassure than just to picture the colon.
Yeah, the truth is that actually doing a colonoscopy is not reassuring the patient. It's what we think, right? We do the colonoscopy because the patient is demanding to have a colonoscopy, and both the patient and the physicians will be more reassured. But unfortunately, studies have looked at this, whether a patient has never had a colonoscopy, had a recent colonoscopy, or had a colonoscopy further down the line. It doesn't make any difference. The patients are as reassured in all of these groups. So doing colonoscopy will not reassure them. That's one thing. The other thing is you need to explain the symptoms. You need to explain to the patient that these symptoms that they are presenting with are not the symptoms that you would expect in case of a colorectal cancer. But again, if the symptoms would change, if there would be blood in the stools, if the patient is losing weight, that's something else. In that case, you may do a colonoscopy, but not in everyone.
Well, I guess most of your practice is incredible communication skills and knowledge. But what else do you use? What's your favorite adjunct in managing functional disorders? Do you have some secret weapons, last resort?
Good question. But let me start by repeating again that communication, education, and taking your time is so important. So when I see these patients, often it will be 30, 45, 60 minutes that I spend with these patients, listening to them, confirming their symptoms. This is really a big part of the treatment of disorders of gut-brain interaction, and also making a positive diagnosis and telling them the diagnosis. So we are aware that the diagnosis that we are thinking about is irritable bowel syndrome, but think about it. How often do you communicate this to your patients? Often we say, well, we did a few tests, it's all reassuring, so I will give you a spasmolytic drug. But you haven't actually named the diagnosis irritable bowel syndrome, and you have not explained what it is. So that's one thing. Make the diagnosis, tell the diagnosis, and explain it. But then in terms of other tips and tricks that you can use, what I think is important is that as a gastroenterologist, we should all be comfortable using neuromodulators. So antidepressants, antipsychotics, to treat abdominal symptoms. And we tend to be a bit hesitant, right? Because we think this is more for the psychiatrist and this is not what we are trained to do. But it's not so difficult. If you know of each and every class, an SSRI, a tricyclic antidepressant, a serotonergic antidepressant, if you know one or two products and you know the doses and you know in which indications, it's not so hard. So you should be comfortable using these drugs. Also not being afraid to combine a few drugs, and this will really improve your practice. And this is why at UGW, there are many sessions about the use of neuromodulators in the postgraduate course, but also in the main program. These are important sessions. This is something that we are less familiar with, but this is something that should be knowledge that you should have as a gastroenterologist as well.
You're very right, because I only use sulpirid and amitriptyline for the lower. And everything else I would outsource to a psychiatrist.
Yeah, that's a pity. That's a pity because there is so much more, right? I mean, amitriptyline is fine, but there is duloxetine that you can use for pain. If you are stuck, you can start combining amitriptyline and pregabalin, for example, for pain. If the patient is really complaining of fullness and the weight is going down, you can use mirtazapine or sulpiride, as you were mentioning. But there is such a richness in these neuromodulators and in the combination of neuromodulators. It's a whole new world, but you should understand how they work. So this is definitely something that is really important in disorders of gut-brain interaction. And also nutrition. So let's not forget nutrition as well. We as gastroenterologists, we tend to neglect a little bit what our patients are eating, and we know more or less what a low FODMAP diet is, I hope. But there is so much more than just a low FODMAP diet as well. It's about fiber content. It's about processed food. It's about taking your time to eat, regular meal times, and so on and so forth. So this is also a very important part of your history taking. So we looked into anxiety and stress and depression and so on, but let's not forget what you eat and how you eat. This is also an integral part of what you should address during your medical history taking.
I wonder, because I face a phenomenon where the patient is so consumed by what he's eating and, you know, self-reflecting what the food does and each product, and they eliminate more and more until their existence is miserable because they don't drink coffee, nothing spicy, nothing tasty. What do you do? How do you get out of that?
That's a very important point as well. And it is important that you pick this up as a gastroenterologist. This is what we call RFID, right? I think you've heard about this abbreviation. It's RFID. It's called Avoidant and Restrictive Food Intake Disorder. And this is really what you are describing. Patients are associating certain of their symptoms to a specific food item, which then they will eliminate. Of course, they will still have certain symptoms. They will associate this with another food item and they will eliminate as well. And so this is why they are eating less and less and less. And in the end, they are drinking water and eating gluten-free crackers, and that's it. And of course, this is not where we should be. And if you have a patient like this, really a multidisciplinary treatment is key. And so it's you as a gastroenterologist, but you need to involve a dietitian who understands this very well, and also a psychologist who knows what RFID is. And we should be aware that this is a problem and that this is also a risk of the of certain elimination diets. So if we put too much emphasis on what they should not eat, because this may cause symptoms, then some of these patients will be pushed into this condition called RFID. And so we are making their lives miserable. So you should be aware that this is a danger of certain of these elimination diets, absolutely.
And I think the stress over eating causes aggravation of the symptoms because it's so stressful.
Absolutely. It's stressful. It's anxiety. They want to stick to what they call safe food items and they will not eat anything else. Just because they feel comfortable with having their gluten-free cracker and one or two additional items. And then they start losing weight. And then you need to give them artificial nutrition, enteral feeding, and sometimes even parenteral feeding. And this is not a road where you want to go in. So you need to pick this up early enough and work together with a dietitian and hope that they will not enter into this eating disorder.
And it's so not tasty. Like Italian cuisine is out of the window with the FODMAP. It's just devastating.
Well, it can be difficult, but with a low FODMAP diet, if you have a dietitian who knows this, you can eat many things. I mean, Italian cuisine is possible, but in this case, you may prefer spelt pasta over the regular white wheat pasta, for example, because this contains less fructans, will give less fermentation, less bloating. So there are definitely options, but this is not something that you can put into the hands of a patient. You need a dietitian who will help you with the reintroduction phase, because everyone can do elimination phase. I can look up on Google, what can I eat? What should I not eat? And then I will develop RFID. But you need a dietitian work with you how to reintroduce certain food items and then see whether you can tolerate or not tolerate specific food items. So don't try it at home. You need a dietitian.
Okay, I will try to, because yeah, up until now, it would be Control P. This is the sheet.
I understand. I really understand, but you should never do that. I did this in the beginning, but the problem is that the patients will take this to the letter and they will never eat these food items again. This causes them fear. And then if they still have symptoms, they will eliminate even more. So these lists are something that I will never hand out to my patients. This is really something that can cause these eating disorders and fear of eating. So don't do it anymore.
In my defense, I do explain that this is not something you have to eliminate completely. But if you have a choice, maybe choose something from that column instead of the avoid column.
That's not bad at all. It's not unacceptable, but this will keep the patient in the elimination phase as well. And so the reintroduction phase is really key. And then the third phase where the patient has his or her diet, which works, is also important. So it's good to have a dietitian in your team.
Noted. Okay, so how will we measure? Because what constitutes successful or at least meets the expectations functional clinic in your mind? How do you define success in functional disorders?
It depends on the patient. And this is also why it can be challenging. And so our goal is not to lower the fecal calprotectin below 100. Our goal is to have patient satisfaction. And this is something that you need to discuss with your patients and to set expectations right. That's also important. And because if you would ask a patient, what do you want me to do? Well, they will tell you, I want to get rid of my symptoms. I want to be symptom free. But you need to be realistic. And so often I will mention to my patients that there will always be some degree of symptoms, or usually you will experience something. And this may get worse when you're stressed or when you're anxious. So the goal should not be to be completely symptom-free, but to reduce these symptoms to a manageable level. And if you address this in your first or second clinic, patients will understand this. And sometimes it can help if you mention like a number, like, what if I could reduce your symptom by a third? Would this already be helpful? And then you can use this to define success. And maybe if for example, you have started one treatment, it did help, and the symptoms are better by 30, 40%, well, maybe we can add something else, and maybe we can get to 50 or 60%. And this will help the patient also to rationalize their symptoms and to see, where am I? Also, often I will talk to the patient, well, remember where you were when we first saw each other 1 year ago? Oh, yes, I remember. Now I'm much better. Because even I do have symptoms, I can predict when I will have symptoms, when I have more stress, but also when I'm out eating in a restaurant and I'm eating more of these challenging foods. I eat it, I have symptoms, but it doesn't scare me anymore. I can live my life and I will not avoid social activities and so on. But of course, we should be honest, it doesn't work in everyone. I'm not trying to tell you that every patient can be helped perfectly, but even in that case, what I will tell them is I cannot promise you that this first treatment will be the perfect one, but I can promise you that I will keep following you and that we will work together trying to get you better. And even if it doesn't work, I will keep seeing you. This commitment to keep following up the patient, no matter what the symptoms are, is also important. Patients will feel safe when they know that they will not be sent away.
I guess it demands a lot of mental and emotional energy out of you, those clinics.
I cannot deny that. It takes time, it takes patience, and it does require mental energy. But it also gives you lots of satisfaction. Let's not forget that, because these are patients who have been suffering for a long time, often young individuals who have stopped studying or retreated from social life and so on. If you can help them a little bit, getting reintegrated again, living again a reasonably normal life, they are so thankful. So it is also a very satisfying subdiscipline in gastroenterology. So I would really recommend it to do it as well. If you know how to do it, if you learn the communication skills and you know the treatments, it's also a very satisfying subdiscipline to be in.
Wrapping things up, you've already talked about what success in the functional disorders, but it's also regarding outcomes, it's a weird and particular field in gastroenterology because we do not have objective measures. The main outcome is patient-reported outcome. So everything from the guidelines to our practice is a bit weird in comparison to other guidelines where we have, for instance, calprotectin or histological remission in IBD.
Yes.
How do you think it affects our evidence-based practice in every day?
Yeah. It may sound a bit weird, and it is different from other subdisciplines, but in the end, it's all that matters, right? Whether your patient is feeling better or not. And as you know, also patients with IBD, even if their calprotectin is normal, they can still have very bad symptoms. So even there, communication, treating your patient, treating the symptoms, and not just the calprotectin is key as well. And also there in IBD, patient-reported outcomes are becoming more and more important, and rightfully so. In the end, it's all about the symptoms. So for me, this is not a disadvantage of disorders of gut-brain interaction. It makes you focus on what matters, the symptoms, and it makes you listen to your patients. How does this affect the guidelines? Well, we look at validated questionnaires, ways to measure their symptom burden in the most objective way with questionnaires that are validated in clinical trials. But this is absolutely feasible. It's just something that you need to understand. And it also requires a different set of skills, as we discussed previously.
By the way, just a quick question, because we talked about the patient outcomes. And when you talk like with the patient, where were you a year ago? Do you get those questionnaires to the patient so that you could have a starting point and, you know, follow up? Do you do that in clinical practice besides research?
Yeah, of course. In Leuven, where I work, we are a big center for disorders of gut-brain interaction. So we do a lot of research and many of our patients will be in some kind of research study. So we use a lot of these questionnaires. But even in your regular practice, there are many questionnaires that you can actually use. And there are screening questionnaires for anxiety and depression, which can be very useful and do not take too much time. The Bristol stool form scale, we all know this, right? You show them the different forms of the stool and your patients will indicate this. There's also a patient-reported outcome and very useful in your clinical practice. And there are others. For example, we have developed, together with Professor Tak, developed this questionnaire where the symptoms are shown as a kind of a pictogram to explain them what is postprandial fullness. What is epigastric pain? What is nausea? Because patients may understand these symptoms very differently from what we as physicians think that nausea means. And so this is what we call the waiting room questionnaire. And it's something that you can already ask the patient to fill out in the waiting room. They will also indicate what is the most bothersome symptom for them. And then they come to you and you can use these questionnaires indeed as a basis to start from. Can be quite useful. Absolutely.
Okay, Tim. Thank you so, so much for your time, your advice, your knowledge, and your patience.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
I hope it was useful to the audience as well, as much as it was to me. So thank you, Tim.
A pleasure. Thank you, Egli.
Let's see where we are, let's say, in 6 months, and we will reevaluate the outcomes.
Perfect. Give it a try. You will like it.
Thank you, audience, for joining us, and we will see you in the next one. Bye.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to UEG Podcast. We hope you've found some new ideas, insights, and inspiration to take with you. Don't forget to subscribe, and if you like our content, please leave us a review and share our podcast with your colleagues.